from her. "The jacket you borrowed from me in the park yesterday," he said. "Do you still have it?" Now looking even more puzzled, Clary pointed to where the item of clothing in question, a perfectly ordinary brown suede jacket, was hanging over the back of one of the chairs. "It's over there. I was going to bring it to you after." "Well," said Jace, picking it up and thrusting his arms hastily into the sleeves as if he were suddenly in a hurry. "Now you don't have to." "Jace," Luke said in that calming tone he had, "we're going to get an early dinner in Park Slope after this. You're welcome to come along." "Nah," Jace said, zipping up the jacket. "I've got training this afternoon. I better head out." "Training?" Clary echoed. "But we trained yesterday." "Some of us have to train every day, Clary." Jace didn't sound angry, but there was a harshness to his tone, and Clary flushed. "I'll see you later," he added without looking at her, and practically flung himself toward the door. As it shut behind him, Clary reached up and angrily yanked the pins out of her hair. It cascaded in tangles down around her shoulders. "Clary," Luke said gently. He stood up. "What are you doing?" "My hair." She yanked the last pin out hard. Her eyes were shining, and Simon could tell she was forcibly winning herself not to cry. "I don't want to wear it like this. It looks stupid." "No, it doesn't." Luke took the pins from her and set them down on one of the small white end tables. "Look, weddings make men nervous, okay? It doesn't mean anything." "Right." Clary tried to smile. She nearly managed it, but Simon could tell she didn't believe Luke. He could hardly blame her. After seeing the look on Jace's face, Simon didn't believe him either. In the distance, the Fifth Avenue diner was lit up like a star against the blue twilight. Simon walked beside Clary down the avenue blocks, Jocelyn and Luke a few steps ahead of them. Clary had changed out of her dress and was back in jeans now, a thick white scarf wound around her neck. Every once in a while, she would reach up and twirl the ring on the chain around her neck, a nervous gesture he wondered if she was even aware of. When they'd left the bridal store, he had asked her if she knew what was wrong with Jace, but she hadn't really answered him. She'd shrugged it off and started asking him about what was going on with him, if he talked to his mother yet, and whether he minded staying with Eric. When he told her he was crashing with Kyle, she was surprised. "But you hardly even know him," she said. "He could be a serial killer." "I did have that thought. I checked the apartment out, but if he's got an ice cooler full of arms in it, I haven't seen it yet. Anyway, he seems pretty sincere." "So what's his apartment like?" "Nice, for Alphabet City. You should come over later." "Not tonight," Clary said, a little absently. She was fiddling with the ring again. "Maybe tomorrow?" "Going to see Jace," Simon thought, but he didn't press the point. If she didn't want to talk about it, he wasn't going to make her. "Here we are." He opened the diner door for her, and a blast of warm souvlaki-smelling air hit them. They found a booth over by one of the big flat-screen TVs that lined the walls. They crowded into it as Jocelyn and Luke chatted animatedly with each other about wedding plans. Luke's pack, it seemed, felt insulted that they hadn't been invited to the ceremony, even though the guest list was tiny, and were insisting on holding their own celebrations in a renovated factory in Queens. Clary listened, not saying anything. The waitress came around, handing out menus so stiffly laminated they could have been used as weapons. Simon set his own on the table and stared out the window. There was a gym across the street, and he could see people through the plate glass that fronted it running on treadmills, arms pumping, headphones clamped to their ears. "All that running and getting nowhere," he thought. "Story of my life." He tried to force his thoughts away from dark places and almost succeeded. This was one of the most familiar scenes in his life, he thought. A corner booth in a diner, himself and Clary and her family. Luke had always been family, even when he hadn't been about to marry Clary's mom. Simon ought to feel at home. He tried to force a smile, only to realize that Clary's mother had just asked him something and he hadn't heard her. Everyone at the table was staring at him expectantly.
"Sorry," he said. "I didn't... What did you say?"
Justin smiled patiently.
"Clary told me you've added a new member to your band."
Simon knew she was just being polite. Well, polite in that way parents swear when they pretended to take your hobbies seriously. Still, she'd come to several of his gigs before, just to help fill up the room. She did care about him. She always had. In the very dark, tucked away places of his mind, Simon suspected she had always known how he felt about Clary. And he wondered if she wouldn't have wanted her daughter to make a different choice, had it been something she could control. He knew she didn't entirely like Jace. It was clear even in the way she said his name.
Yeah, he said. Kyle, he's kind of a weird guy, but super nice.
Invited by Luke to expand on the topic of Kyle's weirdness, Simon told them about Kyle's apartment. Careful to leave out the detail that it was now his apartment too, his bike messenger job and his ancient beat-up pickup truck.
And he grows these weird plants on the balcony, he added. Not pot, I checked. They have sort of silvery leaves.
Luke frowned, but before he could say anything, the waitress arrived carrying a big silver coffee pitcher. She was young, with bleached pale hair tied into two braids. As she bent to fill Simon's coffee cup, one of them brushed his arm. He could smell sweat on her, and under that blood, human blood, the sweetest smell of all. He felt a familiar tightening in his stomach. Coldness spread through him. He was hungry. And all he had back at Kyle's place was room-temperature blood that was already beginning to separate, a sickening prospect even for a vampire.
You have never fed on a human, have you? You will. And when you do, you will not forget it.
He closed his eyes. And when he opened them again, the waitress had gone, and Clary was staring at him curiously across the table. Is everything okay?
Fine.
He closed his hand around his coffee cup. It was shaking. Above them, the TV was blaring the nightly news.
Ah, Clary said, looking up at the screen. Are you listening to this?
Simon followed her gaze. The news anchor was wearing that expression news anchors tended to wear when they were reporting on something especially grim.
No one has come forward to identify an infant boy found abandoned in an alley behind Beth Israel Hospital several days ago, he was saying. The infant is white, weighs 6 pounds and 8 ounces, and is otherwise healthy. He was discovered strapped to an infant car seat behind a dumpster in the alley, the anchor went on. Most disturbing, a handwritten note tucked into the child's blanket begged hospital authorities to euthanize the child because I don't have the strength to do it myself. Police say it is likely the child's mother was mentally ill and claim they have promising leads. Anyone with information about this child should call Crime Stoppers at.
That's so horrible, Clary said, turning away from the TV with a shudder. I can't understand how people just dump their babies off like they're trash. Jocelyn, Luke said, his voice sharp with concern. Simon looked towards Clary's mother. She was as white as a sheet, and she looked as if she were about to throw up. She pushed the plate away abruptly, stood up from the table, and hurried toward the bathroom. After a moment, Luke dropped his napkin and went after her.
Oh, crap. Clary put her hand over her mouth. I can't believe I said that. I'm so stupid.
Simon was thoroughly perplexed.
What's going on?
Clary slunk down in her seat.
She was thinking about Sebastian, she said.
I mean, Jonathan, my brother, I assume you remember him.
She was being sarcastic. None of them was likely to forget Sebastian, whose real name was Jonathan, and who had murdered Hodge and Max and had nearly succeeded in helping Valentine win a war that would have seen the destruction of all Shadowhunters. Jonathan, who had had burning black eyes and a smile like a razor blade. Jonathan, whose blood had tasted like battery acid when Simon had bitten him once. Not that he regretted it.
But your mom didn't abandon him, Simon said. She stuck with raising him even though she knew there was something horribly wrong with him.
She hated him, though, Clary said. I don't think she's ever gotten over that. Imagine hating your own baby. She used to take out a box that had his baby things in it and cry over it every year on his birthday. I think she was crying over the son she would have had, you know, if Valentine hadn't done what he had.
You would have had a brother, Simon said. Like an actual one. Not a murdering psychopath.
Looking close to tears, Clary pushed the plate away.
I feel sick now, she said. You know that feeling like you're hungry but you can't bring yourself to eat?
Simon looked over at the bleached-haired waitress who was leaning against the diner counter.
Yeah, he said. I know.
Luke returned to the table eventually, but only to tell Clary and Simon that he was taking Jocelyn home. He left some money, which they used to pay the bill, before wandering out of the diner and over to Galaxy Comics on 7th Avenue. Neither of them could concentrate enough to enjoy themselves, though, so they split up, with a promise to see each other the next day. Simon rode into the city with his hood pulled up and his iPod on, blasting music into his ears. Music had always been his way of blocking everything out. By the time he got out at 2nd Avenue and headed down Houston, a light rain had started to fall, and his stomach was in knots. He cut over to 1st Street, which was mostly deserted, a strip of darkness between the bright lights of 1st Avenue and Avenue A. Because he had his iPod on, he didn't hear them coming up behind him until they were nearly on him. The first intimation he had that something was wrong was a long shadow that fell across the sidewalk overlapping his own. Another shadow joined it, this one on the other side. He turned and saw two men behind him. Both were dressed exactly like the mugger who had attacked him the other night. Gray tracksuits, gray hoods pulled up to hide their faces. They were close enough to touch him. Simon leaped back with a force that surprised him. Because his vampire strength was so new, it still had the power to shock him. When a moment later he found himself perched on the stoop of a brownstone several feet away from the muggers, he was so astonished to be there that he froze. The muggers advanced on him. They were speaking the same guttural language as the first mugger, who Simon was beginning to suspect had not been a mugger at all. Muggers, as far as he knew, didn't work in gangs, and it was unlikely that the first mugger had criminal friends who had decided to take revenge on him for their comrade's demise. Something else was clearly going on here. They had reached the stoop, effectively trapping him on the steps. Simon tore his iPod headphones from his ears and hastily held his hands up.
"Look," he said, "I don't know what this is about, but you really want to leave me alone?"
The muggers just looked at him, or at least he thought they were looking at him. Under the shadows of their hoods, it was impossible to see their faces.
"I'm getting the feeling someone sent you after me," he said. "But it's a suicide mission. Seriously, I don't know what they're paying you, but it's not enough."
One of the tracksuited figures laughed. The other had reached into his pocket and drawn something out, something that shone black under the streetlights. A gun.
"Oh, man," Simon said. "You really, really don't want to do that. I'm not kidding."
He took a step back, up one of the stairs. Maybe if he got enough height, he could actually jump over them or past them. Anything but let them attack him. He didn't think he could face what that meant. Not again. The man with the gun raised it. There was a click as he pulled the hammer back. Simon bit his lip. In his panic, his fangs had come out. Pain shot through him as they sank into his skin.
"Don't!"
A dark object fell from the sky. At first, Simon thought something had merely tumbled from one of the upper windows, an air conditioner ripping loose, or someone too lazy to drag their trash downstairs. But the falling thing he saw was a person, falling with direction, purpose, and grace. The person landed on the mugger, knocking him flat. The gun skittered out of his hand, and he screamed a thin, high sound. The second mugger bent and seized the gun. Before Simon could react, the guy had raised it and pulled the trigger. A spark of flame appeared at the gun's muzzle, and the gun blew apart. It blew apart, and the mugger blew apart along with it, too fast to even scream. He had intended a quick death for Simon, and an even quicker death was what he got in return. He shattered apart like glass, like the outward flying colors on a kaleidoscope. There was a soft explosion, the sound of displaced air, and then nothing but a soft drizzle of salt falling onto the pavement like solidified rain. Simon's vision blurred, and he sank down onto the steps. He was aware of a loud humming in his ears, and then someone grabbed him roughly by the wrists and shook him hard.
"Simon! Simon!"
He looked up. The person grabbing him and shaking him was Jace. The other boy wasn't in gear, but was still wearing his jeans and the jacket he'd taken back from Clary. He was disheveled, his clothes and face streaked with dirt and soot. His hair was wet from the rain.
"What the hell was that?"
Jace asked. Simon looked up and down the street. It was still deserted. The asphalt shone black and wet and empty. The second mugger was gone.
"You?"
he said, a little groggily.
"You jumped the muggers?"
"They weren't muggers. They were following you since you got off the subway. Someone sent those guys."
Jace spoke with complete surety.
"The other one," Simon said. What happened to him?"
"He just vanished." Jay snapped his fingers. "He saw what happened to his friend and he was gone. Like that. I don't know what they were, exactly. Not demons, but not exactly human either."
"Yeah, I figured that part out, thanks,"
Chase looked at him more closely. That, what happened to the mugger? That was you, wasn't it? Your mark here.
He pointed at his forehead.
A sideburn white before that guy just dissolved.
Simon said nothing.
I've seen a lot, Chase said.
There was no sarcasm in his voice, for a change, or any mockery.
But I've never seen anything like that.
I didn't do it,
Simon said softly.
I didn't do anything.
You don't have to, said Jace.
His golden eyes burned in his soot-streaked face.
For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord.
Chapter 6. Wake the Dead. Jace's room was as neat as ever, bed made perfectly, the books that lined the shelves arranged in alphabetical order, notes and textbooks stacked carefully on the desk. Even his weapons were lined up along the wall in order of size, from a massive broadsword to a set of small daggers. Clary, standing in the doorway, held back a sigh. The neatness was all very well. She was used to it. It was, she had always thought, Jace's way of exerting control over the elements of a life that otherwise might seem overwhelmed with chaos. He had lived so long not knowing who, or even what, he really was. She could hardly begrudge him the careful alphabetization of his poetry collection. She could, however, and did, begrudge the fact that he wasn't there. If he hadn't gone back home after leaving the bridal shop, where had he gone? As she looked around the room, a feeling of unreality came over her. It wasn't possible that any of this was happening, was it? She knew how breakups went from hearing other girls complain about them. First the pulling away, the gradual refusal to return notes or phone calls, the vague messages saying nothing was wrong, that the other person just wanted a little space, then the speech about how it's not you, it's me, then the crying part. She'd never thought any of that would ever apply to her and Jace. What they had wasn't ordinary or subject to the ordinary rules of relationships and breakups. They belonged to each other totally and always would, and that was that. But maybe everyone felt that way, until the moment they realized they were just like everyone else, and everything they thought was real shattered apart. Something that glittered silver across the room caught her eye. It was the box Amatis had given Jace, with its delicate design of birds around the sides. She knew he had been working his way through it, reading the letters slowly, going through the notes and photos. He hadn't said much about it to her, and she hadn't wanted to pry. His feelings about his biological father were something he was going to have to come to terms with on his own. She found herself drawn to the box now, though. She remembered him sitting on the front steps of the Accords Hall in Idris, holding the box in his lap. "As if I could stop loving you," he'd said. She touched the lid of the box, and her fingers found the clasp, which sprung open easily. Inside were scattered papers, old photographs. She drew one out and stared at it fascinated. There were two people in the photograph, a young woman and a young man. She recognized the woman immediately as Luke's sister, Amatis. She was gazing up at the young man with all the radiance of first love. He was handsome, tall and blonde, though his eyes were blue, not gold, and his features less angular than Jace's. And yet still, knowing who he was, Jace's father, was enough to make her stomach tighten. She set the photo of Stephen Herondale down hastily and nearly cut her finger on the blade of a slim hunting dagger that lay crosswise in the box. Birds were carved along the handle. The blade of it was stained with rust, or what looked like rust. It must not have been cleaned properly. She shut the box quickly and turned away, guilt like a weight on her shoulders. She had thought about leaving a note, but deciding it would be better to wait until she could talk to Jace in person, she left and went down the hall to the elevator. She had knocked on Isabel's door earlier, but it didn't look like she was home either. Even the witchlight torches in the hallways seemed to be burning at a lower level than usual. Feeling utterly depressed, Clary reached for the elevator call button, only to realize it was already lit. Someone was heading up from the ground floor to the Institute. Jace, she thought immediately, her pulse jumping. But of course, it might not be him, she told herself. It could be Izzy, or Maris, or... Luke? She said in surprise as the elevator door opened. What are you doing here? I might ask you the same thing. He stepped out of the elevator, pulling the gate shut behind him. He was wearing a fleece-lined zip-up flannel jacket that Jocelyn had been trying to get him to throw away since they'd first started dating. It was rather nice, Clary thought, that just about nothing seemed to change Luke, no matter what happened in his life. He liked what he liked, and that was that, even if it was a ratty-looking old coat. Except I think I can guess. So, is he here? Jace? No. Clary shrugged, trying to look unconcerned. It's fine. I'll see him tomorrow. Luke hesitated. Clary. Lucien. The cool voice that came from behind them was Maris's. Thank you for coming on such short notice. He turned and nodded at her. Maris? Maris Lightwood stood in the doorway, her hand lightly on the frame. She was wearing gloves, pale gray gloves that matched her tailored gray suit. Clary wondered if Maris ever wore jeans. She had never seen Isabel and Alec's mother in anything but power suits or gear. Clary, she said, I didn't realize you were here. Clary felt herself flush. Maris didn't seem to mind her coming and going, but then Maris had never really acknowledged Clary's relationship with Jace at all. It was hard to blame her. Maris was still coping with Max's death, which had been only 6 weeks ago, and she was doing it alone, with Robert Lightwood still in Idris. She had bigger things on her mind than Jace's love life. I was just leaving, Clary said. I'll give you a ride back home when I'm done here, Luke said, putting a hand on her shoulder. Maris, is it a problem if Clary remains while we talk? Because I'd prefer to have her stay. Maris shook her head. No problem, I suppose, she sighed, raking her hands through her hair. Believe me, I wish I didn't need to bother you at all. I know you're getting married in a week. Congratulations, by the way. I don't know if I told you that before. You didn't, said Luke, but it's appreciated. Thank you. Only 6 weeks. Maris smiled faintly. Quite a whirlwind courtship. Luke's hand tightened on Clary's shoulder, the only sign of his annoyance. I don't suppose you called me over here to congratulate me on my engagement, did you? Maris shook her head. She looked very tired, Clary thought, and there were strands of gray in her upswept dark hair that hadn't been there before. No, I assume you've heard about the bodies we've been finding for the past week or so? The dead Shadowhunters. Yes. We found another one tonight, stuffed in a dumpster near Columbus Park, your pack's territory. Luke's eyebrows went up. Yes, but the others... The first body was found in Greenpoint, Warlock territory. The second floating in a pond in Central Park, the domain of the Fae. Now we have werewolf territory. She fixed her gaze on Luke. What does that make you think? That someone who isn't very pleased about the new accords is trying to set Downworlder against Downworlder, Luke said. I can assure you my pack didn't have anything to do with this. I don't know who's behind it, but it's a very clumsy attempt, if you ask me. I hope the Clave can see through it. There's more, Maris said. We've identified the first two bodies. It took some time, since the first was burned nearly beyond recognition, and the second was badly decomposed. Can you guess who they might have been? Maris. Anson Pagborn, she said, and Charles Freeman, neither of whom, I might note, have been heard from since Valentine's death. But that's not possible, Clary interrupted. Luke killed Pangborn back in August at Renwick's. He killed Emil Pangborn, said Maris. Anson was Emil's younger brother. They were both in the circle together. As was Freeman, said Luke. So someone is killing not just Shadowhunters, but former Circle members? And leaving their bodies in Downworlder territory? He shook his head. It sounds like someone's trying to shake up some of the more recalcitrant members of the Clave. Get them to rethink the new Accords, perhaps. We should have expected this. I suppose, Maris said. I've met with the Seely Queen already, and I've a message out to Magnus, wherever he is. She rolled her eyes. Maris and Robert seemed to have accepted Alec's relationship with Magnus with surprisingly good grace, but Clary could tell that Maris, at least, didn't take it seriously. I just thought, perhaps, she sighed. I've been so exhausted lately. I feel like I can hardly think straight. I hoped you might have some idea about who might be doing this, some idea that hadn't occurred to me. Luke shook his head. Someone with a grudge against the new system. But that could be anyone. I suppose there's no evidence on the bodies? Maris sighed. Nothing conclusive. If only the dead could talk, eh, Lucien? It was as if Maris had lifted a hand and yanked a curtain across Clary's vision. Everything went dark, except for a single symbol hanging like a glowing sign against a blank night sky. It seemed her power had not vanished, after all. What if, she said slowly, raising her eyes to look at Maris, what if they could?
Staring at himself in the bathroom mirror in Carl's small apartment, Simon couldn't help but wonder where that whole business about vampires not being able to see themselves in mirrors had come from. He was able to see himself perfectly well in the dinged surface, tousled brown hair, wide brown eyes, white, unmarked skin. He had sponged off the blood from his cut lip, though his skin had already healed over. He knew, objectively speaking, that becoming a vampire had made him more attractive. Isabel had explained to him that his movements had become graceful and that, whereas before he had seemed disheveled, somehow now he looked attractively rumpled, as if he had just gotten out of bed. Someone else's bed, she had noted, which, he'd told her, he had already figured out, was what she meant, thank you. When he looked at himself, though, he didn't see any of that. The poreless whiteness of his skin, as it always did, disturbed him, as did the dark, spidering veins that showed at his temples, evidence of the fact that he had not fed today. He looked alien, and not like himself. Perhaps the whole business about not being able to see yourself in a mirror once you had become a vampire was wishful thinking. Maybe it was just that you no longer recognized the reflection looking back at you. Cleaned up, he headed back into the living room, where Jace was sprawled out on the futon couch, reading Kyle's beaten-up copy of The Lord of the Rings. He dropped it onto the coffee table as Simon came in. His hair looked newly wet, as if it splashed water on his face from the kitchen sink. I can see why you like it here, he said, making a sweeping gesture that encompassed Kyle's collection of movie posters and science fiction books. There's a thin layer of nerd all over everything. Thanks, I appreciate that. Simon gave Jace a hard look. Up close under the bright light of the unshaded overhead bulb, Jace looked ill. The shadows Simon had noticed under his eyes before were more pronounced than ever, and his skin seemed tight over the bones of his face. His hand shook a little as he pushed his hair from his forehead in a characteristic gesture. Simon shook his head as if to clear it. Since when did he know Jace well enough to be able to identify which gestures of his were characteristic? It wasn't as if they were friends. You look lousy, he said. Jace blinked. Seems an odd time to start an insult contest, but if you insist, I could probably think up something good. No, I mean it. You don't look good. This from a guy who has all the sex appeal of a penguin? Look, I realize you may be jealous that the good Lord didn't deal you the same chiseled hand he dealt me, but there's no reason to. I am not trying to insult you, Simon snapped. I mean, you look sick. When was the last time you ate anything? Jace looked thoughtful. Yesterday. You ate something yesterday, you sure? Jay shrugged. Well, I wouldn't swear on a stack of Bibles. I think it was yesterday, though. Simon had investigated the contents of Carl's fridge earlier when he'd been searching the place, and there hadn't been much to find. A withered up old lime, some soda cans, a pound of ground beef, and inexplicably, a single Pop-Tart in the freezer. He grabbed his keys off the kitchen counter.
Come on, he said. There's a supermarket on the corner. Let's get you some food.